I'm Catherine Gunn, former GCHQ Mandarin linguist and whistleblower prior to the invasion of Iraq over an NSA memo. And I'm here now discussing things about this latest push for technocracy.
One of the things I think has been again and again since we've seen this Omicron stuff on the TV is, I mean, I don't, I'd be interested in your thoughts, but I see this as a sort of domestic version of 9/11, where there's this, war on terror launched that, George Orwell talked about, this whole idea of the war is not meant to be won, it's meant to be continuous, that we seem to have the pandemic from hell that just will not go away now. And it's a domestic operation rather than a, foreign operation by the British, or by the elite against the world. It used to be, now it seems to be against the domestic populations.
Yeah, clearly that seems to be the case. I mean, I think we talked a few weeks back about this phenomenon of how, other nations, or well, some nations and some people have the best of intentions, and they, they don't expect what they do or say to be, misconstrued or anything. But clearly, it seems that this is potentially the case. So this doctor in Botswana, notified as they probably felt was their duty to do, to notify some variant that, they felt that they'd witnessed. However, key thing about this, which nobody is talking about, is that the four travelers who came in, went into Botswana, and this was a PCR test, so presumably they were well enough to travel. If they'd been sick, they wouldn't have been allowed to travel anyway, because the it would have looked suspicious, or maybe their PCR test would have tested positive before they traveled. Anyway, they must have had a PCR test once they'd entered the country. Perhaps it was required, I don't know. And they tested positive. Now, what's key is these four individuals were fully jabbed. They were fully jabbed, and whatever they tested positive for, later was presumably sequenced, and they found some mutations and so on and so forth. So, genuine scientists and genuine doctors thinking they're doing the right thing, go ahead and report it. And of course, this is exactly what our oligarchs want, because they need this constant flow, this narrative of these unending mutations that, just are unknowable, and is the vaccine going to protect us against it or not? And, are we immune to it or not? It's this endless tale that they have been spinning. And the fact of the matter is, everyone has been saying, all the scientists and doctors in Africa, this is not something to be concerned about. It is very mild. There are no hospitalizations. There are no deaths. And the UK itself, it's now what, 22 cases at the last count. Maybe it will go up to 35. Maybe it will go up even to a few hundred or a few thousands. But what is the population of the UK? And once again, what does it mean when they say someone has tested positive? It means nothing. So, as you say, Tony, this is a war on the people. They want everybody to get their booster shots because the booster take-up has been extremely low. And they are insisting, they are desperate to get people to buy into a narrative that this will become a regime of frequent injections, repeated injections on a thrice monthly basis now, which is unheard of in the history of vaccination protocols. And furthermore, the latest video from Professor Sucharit Bhakti should absolutely put a nail in the entire apparatus. So I will be talking about that next or later.
Yeah, why don't you go into that straight away, actually, Catherine, and we can, you know, talk about other things in a minute. But what's Sucharit Bhakti been saying?
Right. So last week, the Doctors for COVID Ethics had their weekly Zoom meeting, which for me is very late in the evening. I managed to hear this part of the discussion or talk, and it was so good that on the spot, other doctors and other people on the call said, look, we need to clip that bit that Professor Sucharit Bhakti has been just said. We should clip that into a short video format and then put it immediately, link to it on our website, because it's absolutely, you know, it's just phenomenal. So I will basically describe what he said. It's a pretty short clip. Everybody should watch it. And according to him, and he's a retired virologist and immunologist, he is one of the most cited virologists and immunologists in his field. He's, you know, very, very expert in his profession. He says that everybody in that field, in his field, should be fully aware of these issues. And this is what he describes. So the human immune system is very complex, but it's very well developed, and it's, you know, it's miraculous in a way, the immune response of the body, according to viral theory. So one of the things that is talked about, bandied about a lot, is antibodies, and that seems to be the only thing that you know, is mentioned in terms of the body's defense mechanism. In fact, according to Professor Bhakti, it's not the most dominant thing at all. It's there are many, many other more significant factors in the immune system. However, even on the basis of antibodies, there are two key differences. There are two types of antibodies that, in essence, don't intermix, and they work in different parts of the body. So one lot of antibodies, one type of antibodies, generally circulates in the blood, in the veins and vessels. It's transported in the blood. And the purpose of this is to capture pathogens and destroy them before they enter a significant organ in the body. The other type of antibody exists in your respiratory and digestive system. And so pathogens that enter the body via the nose, a mouth, or eyes, presumably, is then intercepted by antibodies that are moving about in your respiratory tract and your digestive tract. And because these two things are distinct, basically distinct, it is well known in scientific literature, according to him, that sticking a needle in somebody's arm with whatever cocktail you've produced does nothing to protect you against a respiratory borne virus, or which may develop into an infection. So the whole basis of jabbing people in the arm, whether it is into the muscle, done properly according to all medical procedures of aspirating the needle and jabbing it into your muscle rather than into a blood vessel, or, you know, doing that, has absolutely no effect on something which is going to enter you via your nose, mouth, or eyes. And this is the crux of the whole issue. And he says he doesn't know why he didn't put two and two together and explain it better previously, because he said it's well known. It's why there has never been a successful attempt at making a vaccine for the common cold. It simply does not work. And the flu vaccines are not particularly effective. You know, they are estimated to be anywhere between 30 and 60% effective. But that's a good question, Tony, and he didn't address that. However, he did say that flu vaccines, which are nasal sprays, may be more effective. But that's debatable.
Okay, so let me just relate to you something that Dr. Stanley Laham shared with us. Well, it must be about 6 months ago now, maybe May or June this year, and that's 2021. And that is that he had a very close look at the effectiveness of the flu vaccines over the last decade or so. And, you know, he's a retired immunologist, very, very familiar with these sorts of viruses, based in Florida. And he was saying that in the year 2018, or the season, the flu season 2018 to 2019, it became absolutely clear, because there were the highest ever rates of people getting flu vaccines and actually the highest ever deaths due to flu. It became absolutely clear to anybody who was looking clearly at the statistics, and it started to become discussed in the profession that the flu vaccine had failed. It was quite clear that this was not an effective vaccine, and it really wasn't helping people at all.
Yeah, well, personally, I tend to agree with that. I think the whole flu vaccine thing, it was the first sort of salvo, if you like, into this whole preparing people for the concept of vaccines that protect you against, you know, circulating sort of infections that are seasonal and, you know, respiratory in nature. And, you know, because as I've said before, I tend to a more holistic, naturopathic sort of view of health and well-being, I've been, you know, very suspicious of flu vaccines myself. And I've noticed, it seems that since they introduced nasal flu sprays into the school population in the UK, that has increased the number of cases of flu, and I mean proper cases, not just positive cases, proper cases of flu where people are ill, and in fact probably death. So yes, I would, you know, I'm sure he's looked into the statistics and data more than I have, because I haven't actually looked into the flu thing, but I would agree. So so I think that basically, you know, adds more fuel to this, that the reason this suddenly occurred to him, and he, you know, presented this sort of 10-minute monologue, which then was clipped into a shareable video, was because he was disgusted by the repeated claims that people who get sick after the first and second and even booster jab are getting sick because it's vaccine failure. You know, it's, well, the vaccine didn't take in them. You know, their body didn't produce sufficient antibodies for it to work, or whatever the argument may be. That's basically BS, according to him and according to the literature. These are not breakthrough cases, as they are trying to maintain. This is just evidence that the jabs just simply do not work. They simply are not capable of working. End of story. Now, what they do, which is also established by scientific literature from decades back, and which has been, you know, mentioned repeatedly for the last 8-10 months, is antibody dependent enhancement. And I'm sure Dr. Laham has talked about this as well. Antibody dependent enhancement, which is when the body, a person who has received a injection, when they come across a pathogen, another cold type virus, and, you know, they're unable to defeat it naturally with their own immunity, what will happen is that immunity, their natural defense systems will overreact. They will overcompensate and create a cytokine storm, or it has the potential to develop into a cytokine storm, when in fact your body overreacts to such an extent that it's attacking itself and shutting down your major, your systems. And that is what we need to be talking about, not vaccine breakthrough. It's ADE. These people are suffering from ADE. Or in fact, what a group of Doctors for Ethics doctors have been actually calling it, spikeopathy. So it's a new terminology that they're trying to get through to the corporate media. The fact that these people have now injected this spike protein into their body, they are developing a pathology of spike proteins. And, you know, the literature on coronavirus or COVID-19 and the spike protein, which is allegedly so toxic and so dangerous, is what is apparently in these injections, right? And so we're injecting this toxic protein supposedly directly into the body, sometimes into the veins, and, you know, and it's literally lacerating the endothelial cells of the body in the veins. And so the endothelial cells covering the inside of the veins is extremely smooth, apparently. It's like silk or glass. It's so smooth in normal, healthy circumstances. And so it just enables blood to flow freely through the vessels and the veins. But the spike goes through and basically scratches it and destroys it so that it becomes ragged and torn, and then when the body tries to repair that, it starts clotting, and that's how you're getting these clots forming inside all these veins and vessels, and you're getting all these strokes and blood clots and cardiac events. And it was clear from the start, they knew from the start, Doctors for COVID Ethics and others knew from the start that this is what would happen, and they wrote letters to the EMA, the European Medicines Agency. They wrote letters to others, you know, insisting that the whole process should halt immediately because they could tell this is what was going to be the result. In fact, and there's so much to go through today, Tony, but in fact, Pfizer's own documents show that they know they are keeping score, and they knew from the very beginning, from within the first 2 months of injecting scores of millions of people in the US and the UK and around the world, that it was having devastating effects, devastating adverse events, and in fact, thousands of deaths. And, you know, they know this. They know this. And yet they are, you know, they're indemnified. They're indemnified in every country by virtue of their contracts, which are completely redacted, and no one can read them and see them because they blacked them all out. So this data from Pfizer, which came out recently, the fact that they, a group of professionals in the US, I think doctors and professionals, wanted, they sent a Freedom of Information request to Pfizer to say that they wanted to see all the data that was available that Pfizer had on these rollouts. So the group is called the Public Health and Medical Professionals for Transparency Documents. And right, so they sent this request to the FDA and or to Pfizer and the FDA, and the response was that it would take 55 years for all of the relevant data to be released, so until 2076. But they have released 90 pages, apparently, of about 300,000 pages. And within the first 90 pages, there is a link, or there is data or document about the serious adverse events that occurred, which occurred within the first 2 months. Now, I did actually download the link. So here we go. So they actually say in this document, at the beginning of this document, you know, they blow their own trumpet. So in this document, they say, Pfizer is responsible for the management post-authorization safety data on behalf of the MAH BioNTech, according to the pharmacovigilance agreement in place. Data from BioNTech are included in the report when applicable. They say Pfizer's safety database contains cases of adverse events reported spontaneously to Pfizer, cases reported by the health authorities, cases published in the medical literature, cases from Pfizer-sponsored marketing programs, etc., etc. They also say that reports, because they are submitted voluntarily and the magnitude of the underreporting is unknown. They don't say overreporting. They say the magnitude of underreporting is unknown. This has to be borne in mind when you look at the data. There's also a section where they actually, as I say, they blow their own trumpet about how they're able to deal with this, and they repeatedly say considerable number of adverse events. Here we go. They say the increased volume of reports has not impacted case processing for serious reports. and compliance metrics continue to be monitored weekly, with prompt action taken as needed to maintain compliance with expedited reporting obligations. Non-serious cases are entered into the safety database no later than 4 calendar days from the receipt. Entrance into the database includes the coding of all adverse events. This allows for a manual review of events being received, blah, blah, blah. Pfizer has also taken multiple actions to help alleviate the large increase of adverse event reports. This includes significant technology enhancements and process and workflow solutions. This is interesting because I don't know if you're aware, but Heiko Ku, you know, who has frequently been speaking out and speaks out at Hyde Park Speaker's Corner. He actually, with a couple of other guys, managed to get inside Pfizer headquarters in the UK. So it was a fairly laborious process, but they basically went in on the guise of inspecting, I think it was about the fifth floor of the Pfizer building because it was being let out. So they contacted an estate agent who was advertising this space, which was inside the Pfizer building. So they were letting out the top floor, I think, of their building. So they went in as business or whatever company, and they were interested in taking over the space. They got inside the Pfizer building. They maintained their cover for a good number of minutes, and they managed to observe that there were really no more than 10 members of staff within the whole building. It was a massive building. And he discussed with this chap about, you know, what was going on at Pfizer, how were they managing the workflow and so on. And he claimed that a lot of people were choosing to work from home. So that's interesting when you bear in mind what they're saying in this report about how they have all these things in place to monitor these adverse events. But this is what they compiled. This is what is available on their database so far. It says from the 1st of December 2020 through 28th of February 2021, this is what they noted. Cumulatively, there was a total of 42,086 case reports, 25,000 plus were medically confirmed, and nearly 17,000 were non-medically confirmed. Within these 42,000+ reports, there were 158,000 events. So like in the MHRA system, the number of events far higher than the number of cases, because each person, each case, at least 2 or 3 at minimum adverse events. So they noted within just 2 or 3 months, they had over 42,000 adverse events. And they also had significant numbers of deceased.
Well, look, before you go on, this is totally opposite, Catherine, isn't it, to the way that COVID itself is reported, where we have the number of events much, you know, in other words, where something is actually happening, in other words, that somebody has got a runny nose, for example, far less than the number of cases, because we've got so many cases of COVID, which are so-called tested positive, either with the lateral flow test or a PCR test, that have no symptoms at all.
Right. Well, I mean, they're a nothing burger, basically. Exactly. So, you know, and they knew this. They knew this within 2 months. 1,223 deaths, according to them, in 2 months. And that is just the absolute top of this iceberg. You know, the MHRA have reported, and in fact, there was, you know, there's so much, there's just this avalanche of information that keeps coming out, and it's almost impossible to record it all and take it all in. I remember when, you know, when the injections began in the beginning of this year, and in Scotland, they recorded, I think within the first couple of months, and the focus was on the over 80s, obviously the over 75 and over 80s. The number of deaths was staggering. It was about 2,000. So, I mean, where do you go from this? I just don't know. Where do you go from this? Pfizer is a criminal organization. They are the most heavily fined company in the history of pharma companies. They lie, they cheat, they fudge their data. You know, it's just, and yet the CEO is able to accuse, you know, those of us who are trying to expose them as being conspiracy theorists and guilty of misinformation and disinformation, and that they should be locked up. I mean, it's quite, we're living in a madhouse, Tony, I'm beginning to feel like. So, you know, the adverse events are really, really just the tip of the iceberg, what's even reported in the MHRA and yellow card and you know, the VAERS system in the US and so on. It is really only the tip of the iceberg. And yet, despite that, the numbers are staggering, because they have never seen such a huge spike in reactions for over 30 years of data collection by these very own monitoring systems. They have it all of the when you look at the graphs that people have made of the number of reactions in the last 12 months, the previous 30 years, it's virtually flatlined. You know, the line on the graph is virtually completely flat with a few tiny, tiny little bumps. And then when you come to 2020 and 21, the spike, it's like a 30 centimeter spike straight up. And that is, if you know, the whole point of these monitoring systems is that they are a signal. They are meant to be a signal to pick up when something is going wrong. They know something is wrong. They know absolutely 100% they know what's going on. They are still pushing on regardless, because they are trying to get everybody conditioned into believing that we are constantly in danger of a dangerous virulent pathogen, and that we need medical intervention to protect us against it. But not only that, more importantly, we need proof. We need to have a digital proof that we are protected against any such pathogen. What they want is for us to be able to show everywhere we go, at whatever checkpoint they decide to set up, that we, in theory, according to their definitions, are healthy enough to go through that checkpoint. And it is all about the so-called vaccine pass, which, you know, has various names. In the EU, it's the Green Pass. In Lithuania, it's the Convenience Pass. It, wherever you go, it has a different name. All of these countries, everywhere, including in Russia, China's already got it. Everywhere you go, they want you to have a ID 2020. That's what this is all about. And it's clear. It's clear. And that's what we all said, those of us who were aware of what was going on. We all said this 8, 9, 12 months ago. We were telling people this is going to come down to a pass. And, you know, people laughed at us. Oh, shut up. Put your tinfoil hat on. Get out of here. But this is the reality. And people are getting it, not because they're afraid of some poxy virus, but because they want to be able to travel, or because they want to go to their local cinema, or because they want to, go get medical treatment. That's no flipping reason to give in to this tyranny. And not only that, people are allowing their children to get jabbed, encouraging their children to get jabbed, so that they can, quote unquote, participate in society. I mean, talk about handing your children to the slave master. This is what Catherine Austin Fitz has been describing. We are walking into a control grid. We are erecting our own prison by complying with this thing for the sake of convenience.
Well, just one example. I was chatting to a journalist who's just quit her job in New Zealand. She doesn't want to get the jab. She's also found a lot of her work, I won't say what outlet she's working for in New Zealand. She's found a lot of her work censored. Her husband is in the UK. Neither of them want to get jabbed. So although they have planning the rest of their lives in New Zealand, it now looks as if, because of the rules in New Zealand, that they are not going to be able to live in New Zealand, because her husband simply will not be allowed back into the country at all.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. The positive thing with them pushing it so far, when clearly there is no justification whatsoever for any of it, is that a lot of people now are really sick to the back teeth of it. And that seems to be very evident. So now the whole carrot and stick thing, the carrots have been tried. We're going to see them wheeling out a stick, which is what they're doing in Greece now, apparently. For those over 65, if they haven't been jabbed, they're going to be fined. Something like, I don't know, I can't remember what amount. Significant sums of money.
Yeah, it's 100 euros a month.
100 euros a month. And they're already struggling. You know, wasn't Greece the one that got completely screwed by the EU and the IMF? So they're already struggling. They've had their savings stolen, taken from them. And now they're going to impose upon the over 65s, whose pensions are probably worth nothing, £100, €100 fine every month if they refuse to get the jab.
Well, the obvious corollary there is that if people refuse to pay or cannot pay, they will be going to prison in Greece.
Well, that's what this may come to, is that, you know, if significant numbers of people refuse to pay, I mean, the establishment, the oligarchs, they have a goal in mind. They're not doing this because they keep mucking up. I mean, it's clear now. It's not a case of incompetence. this is planned. They have an agenda. They're working to an agenda. It's not going as well as planned. But this is all sunk costs to them, as I've said before. This is sunk costs. There's no going back. And they're going to keep pushing forward regardless. They're going to keep pushing forward and criminalizing more and more people, as Dr. Professor Matthias Desmet has said, in the worst case scenario, you know, in these types of mass formations, if it gets to the point where there's no return and you cannot break this tyrannical mass formation or mass psychosis, the tyranny turns against all, not just a select few. It turns against all, and it just self-destructs, but it's a massively destructive process. So, you know, that's why this constant speaking up and pointing out the inconsistencies and pointing out the lies and the data manipulation and the harm, the devastating harm, is going to hopefully make the 40%, or approximately 30 to 40% of people who have just been keeping quiet. They haven't fallen prey to the hypnosis. They are not in a trance. They're awake. They can see what's going on, but they're keeping shtum because they think, well, you know, I don't want to lose my job here. I've got to feed the family. But it's getting to the point now where even those people are thinking, bloody hell, this is getting too much. You know, I'm not going to be able to eat anyway. So I might as well just bloody well speak out now. And I think that's where some people are getting to that point. But those who are still in hypnosis or still too afraid, I mean, I think there's another analogy, another way of looking at it is that some people are just, they literally think they're going to lose their mind if they face this monster, because the monster is immense. The tyranny is total, and the devastation that has already happened and that is potentially looming is just unfathomable at this stage. And for people who haven't gradually built up to this point, it's probably an absolutely terrifying position to be in, to try and take it all in. So they're just like an ostrich burying their head in the sand because they're afraid that they're just literally going to maybe have a nervous breakdown or something. You know, and it's a terrible position to be in. But, you know, all the comments in all of the various publications now, ever since they started banging on about this ridiculous variant and the fact that, you know, boosters, everyone's got to have a booster and they've got to have it every 3 months and so on. You know, even the comment sections now are just ablaze with anti-establishment comments. So I think people are getting it finally.
Have you got anything to say about Craig Murray? Because it's quite nice. I mean, much of what we discuss, Catherine, has got to do with a complete failure of journalism, too, in the mass media. Although there has been, I remember listening to talk radio this week to hear Mike Graham on there having the sort of rant almost that you just had against the Omicron variant, saying that we've had enough of this, basically, you know, we're not taking this anymore. In fact, he even repeated the line from the, I think, is it Network, the film, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. You know, so this is the idea that really that this is nonsense. I mean, we saw the BBC on Monday reporting that nobody was actually hospitalized at all with Omicron in South Africa. The woman doctor that first reported it over there, saying that all the big fuss about it in Europe and the United States about Omicron was a storm in a teacup. That's how she described it. So it's nice to see that somebody, at least who's been doing some excellent blogging, and who we had up at the National Union of Journalists conference many years ago, doing a terrific talk at the New Media Council, the little event that takes place just before the conference itself starts, that Craig is now out of jail. So, at least there is some sort of hope, I suppose, that we may be able to at least go to a blog and read stuff, because he was jailed in a similar way to Julian Assange, after really, on the face of it, not really committing what appeared to be any crimes at all. He was sent to jail, but now at least he is out, even if Julian isn't.
Yeah, now I watched that live feed on Facebook yesterday. He was he was had a big welcoming team. It was extremely windy, so the actual speech that he gave was inaudible for the most part. But yeah, it's great. It's great that he was able to come out on St. Andrew's Day as well, which I think had a lot of meaning for those who are strongly in favor of Scottish independence. I hope, I'm sure he's going to write about it. I can't wait to hear his accounts and his, some of the, thoughts. And I mean, he had 4 months inside, apparently a lot of the time in solitary confinement for what was what? Jigsaw identification, contempt of court, or whatever the charge was, which is frankly, it's just, again, another example of the total abuse of power, obscene overreach, and the ridiculous, well, it's not ridiculous, it's the tyrannical targeting of opposition. Anybody who opposes this tyranny in whatever form they see it in, whether it's in terms of freedom of press, freedom of expression, whether it's in terms of bodily integrity, and freedom of choice to what you do with your body, and so on, however you see this tyranny, and you try and speak out about it, you're a target. You become a target of the state and
Yeah, I mean,
of
this the whole business of contempt, though, is quite a serious crime, and contempt of court. That is to say, you are simply not allowed to identify people who the judge says will not
But
be
he didn't.
identified in a
But
court
he didn't.
case.
He
Yeah,
didn't
but
identify anybody.
so
And
yes, but
he
if
did
you
no
sit
more or
down.
no less than what the mainstream press did.
But if you sit down and take the various bits of information that Craig Murray gave out about these people who were doing this prosecution, at least, I mean, they were giving evidence anyway, anonymously, against Alex Salmond. That if you were to sit down and do a lot of hard work, you may be able to figure out who these people were. So that's why he was put in jail.
Well, yeah, but as I say, the mainstream press did that as well, I believe. So they gave out the same pieces of information, which, if you did your due diligence, you could put two and two together and get whatever. The fact is, the mainstream, the corporate press, the state-funded press is not the enemy at this state because they're bought and paid for. It's the independent journalists and bloggers and researchers who are, and that's clear. It's become increasingly clear over the last 2 years, but it was evident from way before, from the dawn of the internet, and even before that, in terms of people like Gary Webb and so on, and others. So, the actual attack on journalism and on investigative, independent investigative journalism is what this is about, and it's not. I don't think it actually was anything to do with the Alex Salmond case per se. They used that as an excuse to get him. Personally, I think that's what this was all about. It was because of his his insightful and very damning accounts of Julian Assange's trial, you know, earlier in the year, before the Alex Salmond case. He was writing, you know, in his blog, the full accounts of what was occurring in that tiny courtroom where there were only about 20 people allowed in, and he managed to get in every day to Julian Assange's trial. That, and his support for Julian Assange, and his support and his exposing of Britain's crimes overseas and domestically, that is what got him into prison. Not identifying some women.
Yeah, I can remember him blogging a few years ago about it was the day, it was apparently the third occasion in which he'd been sitting in a taxi being cabbed to the BBC studios, whether in Edinburgh or in London, and the taxi driver had got a call to say, no, turn around, go back home. We don't want Craig. So, you know, it's quite obvious what's going on there is that researchers and producers are deciding that Craig would be a good person to contribute on a live TV programme, maybe Newsnight or whatever. I think that was Newsnight was the occasion that that got him to do the blog. And then a senior editor comes in and says, oh, no, we're not having Craig Murray on live television. Now, I mean, the guy is a former ambassador. He's obviously very well qualified. And I think also he was the lead at the Foreign Office for maritime law as well. So other ambassadors around the world, when they needed a bit of a tip on maritime law, would call Craig up in Azerbaijan or wherever he was ambassador and say, well, we've got a bit of a problem with maritime law here, Craig. Can you put us straight on this? And so he's quite clearly a senior and very credible source, the sort of person that we would expect to see on the TV fairly regularly, giving an alternative view on many matters around the world.
Yes, but I mean, there are, you know, once you become an enemy of the state, essentially, then you're not allowed. I mean, it's like Peter Ford, another former ambassador who doesn't get invited anymore. If I think perhaps he did at one stage, but he's not allowed to speak anymore on those platforms. No controversy is allowed, Tony. No controversy is allowed, is it? You must not say anything that will get anybody's hackles up. The status quo, the establishment, we must not ruffle their feathers too much. It's just not, you know, we cannot expose, that they must not be exposed. But you know, this death grip on the media is going to be the death of them, because as we've seen, you know, the trust in media is at an all-time low. And you say it's a collapse of journalism, but as you say, they've been, you know, like this friend of yours in New Zealand, there are journalists who have been trying for the last 2 years nearly to write about these things. They've written many, many stories over the last 20 months to and submitted it to their papers. And, you know, they've been shut out each time. They've been turned down. And this isn't new either, because, you know, that was covered in the film Official Secrets, where, you know, you saw Ed Velloomy in New York, you know, contacting, or when he was on the phone to The Observer going, you know, this is the 30th bloody article I've written about the Iraqi curveball, that guy that they were trying to hold up as a real intelligence source, who was feeding fake stories about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction to, you know, to the German intelligence and to UK intelligence. And the Observer wouldn't print any of it. So, you know, it's not a new thing, but it's obviously got to a point where, you know, they're just I don't know at what point the editors of these papers will think, well, I mean, it's probably their careers on the line. It's the editors' careers on the line and the journalists. But if the editors allow two controversial stories into the paper, it's their neck on the line, right? So that's why they're refusing to allow these stories to get out. But they'll get out. They are getting out because, you know, everybody's flocking away from, a lot of people, millions are flocking away from corporate and state-funded media.
Yeah, but you see, then there's also this whole thing of confirmation bias, where people who have enthusiastically embraced having the jabs, etc., getting their vaccine passports and things, then they turn the TV on to be reassured that what they've done is right.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid there will always be people like them, you know, until they're the last ones to know. It's a slow process, you know. I mean, I thought this thing, I thought there were enough big exposés 10 months ago, 12 months ago, but, you know, it's a very, very slow process for such vast numbers of people to come round. But eventually I think they will come around. They are coming around because of this whole Omicron booster nonsense, the fact that they're trying to steal another Christmas away from everyone. And this is another thing I was going to bring up today, is this insanity driven by principally those on the left who, well, I say on the left, but this, you know, these measures that are supposed to prevent this dreaded coronavirus from circulating in inside classrooms and so on, so that they keep pushing these non-medical intervention, non-pharmaceutical interventions, such as keeping the rooms well ventilated, spraying various disinfectants around all over the place, forcing children to put on masks, washing their hands obsessively, and so on. But the main thing is this: keeping the rooms well ventilated. A friend sent me an article because she was particularly upset when she sent her child to school this past Monday after the, you know, you've had really freezing cold temperatures in the UK the last week or so, haven't you? And she sent her son to school. He's 6 years old. He had his coat on, you know, obviously to walk to school. But when she went to pick him up from school, she said he was shivering. His hands were freezing cold. He had a runny nose, you know, and basically he came down with a cold because his classroom teacher had kept all of the windows open when it was about 4 degrees or 2 degrees outside. And the kids had been sat in the classroom with their jackets on all day long. They'd been forced to eat their lunch in the classroom because apparently their classroom had a case, and so they weren't allowed out of the classroom either. She was absolutely and utterly disgusted, and then because that had been bugging her, she'd come across another story, and this is a absolutely disgusting incidents which, you know, really I think aptly describes how these teachers in these, you know, schools that are doing these sorts of things are completely deluded. This was in the, I think it was in the Times on Tuesday this week, by Emma Yeomans and Nicola Wolcock. So basically, this is the story. A four-year-old boy developed hypothermia after his school put him in isolation in an outdoor classroom. So this little boy had been sent to school with a runny nose and a slight cough. Now, for four-year-olds, that happens practically on a bi-monthly basis. I mean, some kids are just permanently, they've got permanently runny noses and little tickly coughs or whatever. It's just par for the course when you're that age. Anyways, kids at this Wickton Infant School in Cumbria, staff there, feared that he might have coronavirus and put him in isolation until he could be collected. Apparently the mother, and in Cumbria, you know, it's fairly remote. This mother didn't have a car. She had to get public transport. She eventually got to school to pick up her son. She said he was brought out of an outdoor shed where there had been no heating. He couldn't talk. He was shivering like mad. His hands were red raw. His eyes were watering. He had snot running down his face. He had to eat his lunch in that shed. There were no games, no toys, nothing. She took him to the doctor. The doctor told her to call an ambulance because he had developed hypothermia. I mean, I ask you, when I recounted this story to my husband this morning, he said I would have killed them. He's a hot-blooded Mediterranean. But really, where is everyone's common sense? What has happened to everybody? They're on the NHS and on the on the government website of public health and safety. There are regulations about indoor safe working temperatures. I think most of us who work in the civil, who's ever worked in the civil service, know this. There are maximum allowable temperatures and minimum allowable temperatures. The minimum allowable temperature is about 16 degrees in a room where people are not moving about and physically active. 16 degrees. What is the temperature of a room when the outside temperature is 2 or 4 or whatever and they've got all the windows open? What's the temperature of a shed outside of a school in the school grounds that has no heating in it? And they're basically breaking the law. And when this mother apparently went and made a complaint to the police, they said it was not a criminal matter. What happened if that child died? I mean, seriously, people are in some sort of trance to be able to do this because they have literally lost all common sense.
I suppose the answer is that we've got in many of these key positions as headmasters, headmistresses, etc. And maybe it's more in the civil service than it is in private business. We've got people who simply will stick to the regulations rather than use any common sense at all, that they are actually in that job because they're someone who is pliable, will do as they're told and won't think for themselves. I'm thinking, actually, I don't know why he's just popped into my mind of Mark Drakeford, the First Minister in Wales, who just doesn't seem to have ever had an original thought in his life, but he's very good at reading off of an auto cue.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think the UK, you know, it's been a gradual process of this health and safety type, system that has come in and just eroded any kind of personal responsibility, eroded any kind of sense of proportionality and the UK went mad for health and safety a number of years ago, to the extent where, you know, teachers are not allowed to hug their students, and they're not allowed to apply, you know, cream on their face or whatever, suntan lotion or what have you. You know, they're not allowed to do that. They're not allowed to touch the kids. It's unhealthy. It's abnormal. You know, it's just anti-human. Yes, you have to protect children against abuse. And we've seen there have been massive failings for decades now where those who have tried to warn about abuse have been silenced. And this goes on, and this is a whole other discussion. This is a whole other can of worms, which I haven't really delved into at all. But, you know, all the investigations into historical abuse and so on just get buried, and anybody who tries to point out it's still going on gets shut down or shot, like that poor woman, Jill Dando. You know, these all things in moderation. That's how you stay, how you sustain a sort of stable, functioning type of society and home life. All things in moderation. It seems the UK is all things in extremism. You know, on the one hand, you've got these totally nonsensical extremist policies about not touching a child in case it's construed as abuse, but you're allowed to shove them in a shed and practically lock them up in freezing temperatures because they have a runny nose. And on the other hand, you have, you know, the trans ideology, which I'm sorry, but that's a whole other debate as well. It's all extremist ideology. It's all extremist. It's just insane. Insanity reigns. Come back to moderation and sensibility and proportionality. And, you know, a two-way system whereby we know as much about the government as they know about us, instead of this one-way mirror, you know, where they're looking at us through a one-way mirror and we can see nothing of what they're doing. That's, I know you talked with Martin last week and he was nitpicking about the word totalitarianism. Okay, it's tyranny. Whatever it is, it sucks big time and nobody is going to like it. So let's just bloody well stop complying with it. It's simple as that.
Okay, Catherine Gunn, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.